Chapter 13. Valor Always. When Kotuk heard the whistles, he stopped and listened. It was a language not born out of some strange desire to be different, but instead one of practicality. In an endlessly green continent separated by furrows, valleys, and cliffs that crisscrossed a terrain more hazardous than anywhere else in the world, danger was always present. Anything with legs and instincts could try and cross the rainforest, but an echo faced none of the perils that the mortal body did. The whistling became strangulated with a rising shrill and punctuated with intermittent silence and warbles. Kotuk immediately knew the owner was in dire need of help.
"Too bad for them," Kotuk sighed, pulling the shutters to his window shut.
It certainly dampened the sound, but he still had to endure its annoying echo as the person called for help over and over again. Returning to his game, he sat at the long stump which now faithfully served as a table, even if it did so at an imperfect angle. Rubbing the stubbles on his cheek, he considered the game in front of him. A diamond-shaped board, hewn from a rubber tree, with straight lines crisscrossing the board, much like an intricate spider's web, with stones of sable and rose quartz occupying its intersections.
"There it is," Kotuk said with approval.
Grabbing a stone, he fed one of his flanking soldiers to the gods, and then jumped forward two intersections where he could force a line of control. Then, delicately turning the board so as not to sunder any of the rounded stones, he began pondering what would be the other side's turn. He had to admit, it was not a perfect way to play, as he found some days he had a knack to favor one side over the other. But today, however, Kotuk could proudly admit he remained as unbiased as possible. If he were to one day win, he could not give himself an inch. The whistle trilled again.
"Please, someone, I need help, I fear."
The words became somewhat muddled from there, but then they quickly repeated once more. The whistle trilled again.
"Please, someone, I fear the worst, death if we don't get help."
The whistle began to trill again, and Kotuk's hand wavered as he picked up the rose quartz.
Where to place it?
"Someone, please help us."
The whistle trilled again.
"Will you shut up?"
Kotuk finally yelled at no one in particular.
"Ridiculous how obnoxious people can be," he grumbled.
Although entirely implausible, it felt like they had heard him, and the disturbance died down at last, finally allowing him to consider his next move. Kotuk was so focused on how to beat himself, he nearly knocked the stump and everything on it over when Igwai's heavy fists hammered at his door. Grumbling at the impropriety of the world, he sulked toward the door.
"What is it?"
Kotuk said, opening the door.
"Kotukan, someone needs help. I ran as fast as I could when I heard. It's the herders that live nearby."
Kotuk examined the boy, noticing the crescent of red paint across the top of his face and the club gripped in white-knuckled hands.
"You look ready for war. Did I miss something?"
Kotuk sniffed.
"We have to help them. What if it's those bandits again, and now they're threatening our neighbors?"
"First off, Igwai,"
Kotuk said, using his index finger to push down the boy's club.
"Neighbors live closer than they do. Second, when you whistled for help weeks ago, did they come?"
"Well, no, but..."
"But that's all there is to it,"
Kotuk said, returning to his game. Igwai stared at Kotuk for a long while before stamping the heels of his feet.
"Then don't come, Kotukan, but they need help, and I will answer."
"Stupid boy."
Kotuk knew this game far too well. Igwai was an obedient, good-hearted kid, but he lacked the fire to actually ever do anything without his help. Kotuk called his bluff and began humming over the whistles that were once again trilling. Igwai still had not moved.
"Please help,"
the whistling begged.
"I'm going, Kotukan,"
Igwai finally snapped, stomping away. Kotuk shook his head at the boy's foolishness.
"What does he take me for? He's going to tramp back to his room and gather his things. But then he's going to be too afraid to... There was a slam of the front door, and Kotuk froze. Igwai had actually left. Jumping from his seat, Kotuk threw the shutters to his window wide, allowing the moon's pale face to fill the gloom of his room. Outside, a lanky figure could be seen running toward the whistles, torch in hand. Kotuk was not sure what to do. It was a feeling he had not felt in many years. Frozen, he eventually snapped out of it once Igwai disappeared from view. Punching the wall, he felt a deep pop at the edges of his fist, and before the pain had time to sink in, he flew into a frenzy.
Almighty above and below! Who is this new Igwai? Why is he such an idiot?
Kotuk's heart raced as he considered what the boy had said.
What if they were the same bandits? Why am I even considering that? It's not how these people work. It would be unheard of for them to come back to the same area.
But then again, Kotuk was not feeling entirely rational. He was not even feeling ascendant. Gods, he felt almost human again, and he hated it. Tearing the false flooring up at the foot of his bed, he reached in and found all manners of colorful cloths and strange metallic implements. Pulling it all up, he quickly delineated what he would need, tying long white sashes about his waist. The compartment was deep, and he had to reach down to his bicep to find the things he required. He extracted equipment, donning it with the ease and efficiency of one who had spent hours training in the nuances of such preparation. Kotuk shoved sets of stilt springs aside until his hand touched something sharp and cold. Blindly grasping for its base, he heaved the implement upward. It was a dual-pronged effigy, molded to create two smooth metallic horns that were angled inward, with a bend at its wider base so that they tapered toward each other at the top. Sharp ends provided just a finger's gap between the two, and the bottom was separated by a half-wheel, etched with elongated lines. The effigy was no bigger than his palm, but on the whole, it was greater than anything Kotuk owned, and seeing it gave him pause, filling his stomach with dread.
You promised to never take it up again, Sash. Would you break that oath? You are supposed to be a ghost. What right do you have to meddle in the affairs of mortals? Let the boy go. Let him be his own man and free yourself of that burden.
Kotuk considered the small words springing from his subconscious, and he hated himself for it.
I did tell him he could only rely on himself. This would be no surprise. Igwai is nearly a man and is old enough to understand.
The words made sense. They followed everything Kotuk had preached since giving up his past self. So why did it feel so wrong? Why could he not just throw Valor's symbol away? It was just that, after all. A pair of glyphs meant to represent the Almighty's highest of virtues, even if he had once sworn on it. Looking down, he saw he was wearing the black doubled shirt, silken, glossy, and soft. When had he put that on? Or the sashes, which drooped about his waist like lifeless wings? When had he holstered and loaded the old flintlock? When had he put down Valor? And when had he left the house running down the red clay path after Igwai? The whistling was clear now, and he knew exactly where to go. Shaking his head, Kotuk felt the long ropes of hair move heavily as if in agreeance.
Am I the idiot now?
He knew the answer, of course.
I am going to give that boy my mind and a half after this.
Pulling free two thick wads of cloth from his belt, he recognized the implements as clearly as one would an old friend. Others might have said they were nothing more than one really long strip of fabric and a blanket big enough to cover a hut. A conventional hut, but a hut nonetheless. To Kotuk, however, they were much more than that. Unspooling the sash, he snapped it into a vaulting pole with his touch. His eyes glowed a silver light as he ran and drove the pole into the ground. The momentum carried him, and Kotuk began to lift into the air,
crossing over the precipice of one of the many dividing crevices wrought throughout the land. At the zenith of flight, he released his touch, soaring off the beaten path into the cliff's void. Warm gusts of air burst from the crevasse, and Kotuk unfurled the other cloth. Using his touch, he turned the slits into metal clamps, pulsing them so that they locked him in at the wrists. For a moment more, he plummeted into the gaping maw until a bubble began to form at the top of the cloth, filling it with warm air. Just as quickly as he had fallen, Kotuk now hurtled up and back toward the heavens. Nearby, a flurry of bats chirped at him as he broke through their ranks and scattered them about the starry sky. A short-lived smile broke out across Kotuk's face before he pushed it away with ease. Still, it surprised him to find much of that familiar thrill slumbering deep within himself. Being an ascendant never did lose its luster, after all. Manipulating the cloth, he was able to ride the many thermal vents across the land in the direction of the chirping whistles. Glancing down, he could make out Igwai's torch, a tiny ember in the night.
Good.
He would likely beat him to the source of the whistling, please. The air tickled his face as he angled downward toward the sloping foothills and the homestead from which the sounds came. Kotuk analyzed the stead. The disturbance seemed to be coming from a clear-cut pasture in which two figures, female and male by the looks of them, were kneeling around something, torch staves impaled into the soil about them. Kotuk did not particularly wish for them to know what he was just yet, so he angled toward a dense cluster of trees to land within. Allowing the handholds to revert back to cloth, he folded it into a thick wad that just barely folded over his belt. Pushing through the forest and into the clearing, he whistled to make his presence known.
"Help is here," he said. "What has happened?"
Their whistling ceased, and they cupped their hands about their eyes, searching for the source of the sound. Smiles of relief melted from their face as they realized just who had come to their aid.
"Ghost who walks,"
the man said, stepping in front of his life partner.
"Don't hurt us! It is not her time! Please don't take her!"
Kotuk stopped. He could now see what had the pair in such a panic. Behind them, a heifer spluttered manically along the ground. Shuddering, it fought against the vined ropes which pinned it onto its side. White flecks of spittle bubbled from its mouth as the cow bawled in agony.
"This is what you called for?"
he asked incredulously.
"Just stay back and keep your soul stealing to yourself. Someone will come,"
the man said, whistling once more.
"And what do I look like to you?"
Kotuk asked, striding forward with irritation.
"Stay back, ghost who walks! You have no place on these lands!"
"Quit being an idiot," Kotuk spat. "I am no ghost. And if I was, do you think I would reveal myself to you before stealing this one's soul?"
The two looked at each other, and the woman hesitantly put a hand on her life partner's shoulder with a small nod.
"Why are you here?"
the man asked cautiously.
"I am here because someone decided to call for help over the fact that their cow is having a seizure. If not for that, I'd be enjoying a riveting game of Rue. Now, are you going to let me help you or not? By the looks of it, she doesn't have all night."
Again, the woman slowly nodded. And although the man did not confirm, Kotuk took the silence as affirmation. Dressed in the ascendant blacks, he strode forward, a prowling midnight shadow flowing with silks and fluttering elements caught in the Almighty's breath. He knew how he must have appeared, and so he did not blame the two when they scrambled out of his way. Kneeling beside the heifer, he could almost feel the animal's panic. All manner of cure-alls were strewn about, from wet rags to ritual bowls of finely colored dust. One was filled with water which perfectly captured his reflection. Glowing white eyes shone back at him, a pale mist floating evanescently from them.
"I don't think I'll be escaping my title anytime soon," he sighed.
"What have you tried for this?" he asked. "Now, time is short."
"We tried,"
the man stammered, and led Kotuk through all the remedies they had attempted. Kotuk shook his head.
One of those should have worked. Something else is wrong. But what?
The bovine began to settle, but not in a good way. Her convulsions became less frequent, but more violent. Kotuk observed the way she aimlessly lolled her head in a daze, chewing on whatever was nearest her mouth.
What is it, ghost?
The woman asked.
I'm not sure, Kotuk said. But something isn't right.
Something was off about the whole place, but he could not say what.
Kotukan!
A breathless voice said in confusion.
How did you get here?
Igwai asked, finally reaching the field, torch in hand and short of breath.
Wrong question, Kotuk said. The right thing to ask is, why are you here?
But you're...
Igwai stuttered, trying to remember the correct Hasbian words, but instead gave up and used his native tongue instead.
You're dressed.
Did you expect me to come here naked? This is your fault, and we can talk about it later.
Igwai closed his mouth, barely able to contain the grin on his face.
Idiot. Why does he have to smile like that?
Kotuk frowned, which only made his young charge's smile even broader.
Something's missing, Kotuk murmured,
and quickly filled Igwai in on the situation, while softly patting the poor animal's side.
Strange,
Igwai said, looking about.
Where are the rest of your cattle?
The man looked down, awkwardly shuffling his feet in the grass and clay dirt. Sighing, his life partner rolled her eyes and stepped forward, her arms crossed over her chest and making the biceps flex impressively. Gold rings dangled from long earlobes, and she had the accent of one of the neighboring tribes.
My partner traded the other five for white opium from the Fairskins, she said,
referencing the traders who came to Garnet's shores following each killing.
Puso,
Igwai said, wrinkling his nose at the man.
Shit is right, Kotuk murmured, using the Hasbian word. Wait, that's it. This field doesn't smell like puso. Igwai, you are onto something. When was the last time you fertilized this field?
We haven't yet, except for what Kiko has done herself, the man said. I made the sin of trading our cattle before I had the chance to properly do that. But Kiko is free to graze on the other fields where we used to keep them all. She just liked this one best. We can hardly keep her away.
Touching the red dirt with his fingers, Kotuk pressed it to the tip of his tongue. Heavy, dry, and salty. Holding some up for the other to try, Igwai nodded encouragingly as the couple reluctantly took a taste.
It's dirt. This doesn't tell us what happened or how to help her,
the woman said, motioning at Kiko, who had finally fallen into a half-lidded stupor.
No, but it's salty, Kotuk said. It's probably the reason why she was drawn to this field. Salt draws cows like flies to a fire. And if the grass was not fertilized, then it is possible,
he trailed, picking a handful of grass from the ground. They were such innocent things, with their friendly, lively hue, soft and supple to the touch.
Igwai, dress the cow's wounds. She hurt herself quite a bit. And if my hunch is correct, then hopefully the risk of infection might be our greatest concern.
As the boy jumped into action, Kotuk found a pouch filled with a length of simple thread, and gingerly he wrapped it around a large bundle of grass.
What are you doing, ghost?
But Kotuk shushed them. Touching the thread, he watched as it transmuted into a band of lithe silver. The grass itself seemed to lose some of its color, as hairy sprouts of fabric began to prickle up across the blades like an unshorn face. The fine hairs were all various shades of color, a color which one would not have been able to differentiate without decades of training, something Kotuk had too much of. Beside him, the pair gasped, and even Igwai stopped his work to stare. Sighing, Kotuk closed his eyes, knowing full well that the mist would continue unspooling beneath the furrows of his eyelids. Releasing his draw, an intricate use of touch, he motioned for Igwai to continue his work as he addressed the others.
How has Kiko's milk been? Kotuk asked.
Weak and very thin. At times, it is more like water and is impossible to trade.
The man frowned.
A punishment from the ancestors for your addiction,
his partner spat, before smacking him over the head.
Addiction certainly doesn't help, Kotuk shrugged. But that's not the problem. This field is barren of magnesium.
Magnesium?
The man said, stumbling over the foreign word.
It doesn't matter. If Kiko makes it through the night, she must not eat here until it has been fertilized for at least a season.
You will need to build a fence, Kotuk said, watching as the two exchanged a worried look.
But the ancestors look down on such things,
the woman said.
We cannot offend the taker.
Offended or not, the ancestors have also said it is fruitless to waste your lives, Kotuk said, quoting the shaman's words. This is your trade, and if you throw it away because you won't build a fence for a season, then you will lose everything.
The woman nodded, but did not seem convinced, which was not really Kotuk's problem, so he did not make it his.
If your cow feeds from the fields that have already been proven, then it should help. Tonight, stay by her side, and when she wakes, if you can, feed her fresh grass only from there. Understood?
The two nodded and split, the man hobbling over to help Igwai finish dressing the wounds, and his partner to gather feed from the other pasture. Once finished, Igwai bid the herders farewell with a long, falling whistle, while Kotuk left wordlessly, just like a ghost.
The ghost who walks, he thought,
momentarily enjoying the image of walking away into the shadows with his young charge and the effect it would have on the superstitious couple.
That was amazing, Kotukan!
Igwai exclaimed.
Your eyes brightened exactly the way you described in the book, and touch, I imagined it would be, flashier, but that was better than what I thought.
Kotuk opened his mouth to snap a retort, but for some reason decided against it. They could talk about it tomorrow. It was a good thing Igwai could not see his face that well, otherwise he might have caught the hint of a grin, but only a small one.
Can you teach me how to do that with the touch?
Igwai said, his first serious words since the start of his blabbering parade. Kotuk tried to brush the comment off, but Igwai pushed harder, a strange look in his eyes.
Don't look at me that way. I'm not someone to look up to,
Kotuk wanted to say. It had been a long time since anyone had seriously asked him to teach them the secrets of ascendancy, although he probably should have guessed it would have come up sometime, sooner or later, knowing Igwai.
Why do you want such a power? Do you think it will bring you fame? That girl, perhaps?
None of that, Kotukan,
Igwai said, shaking his head.
I want to be like you, the real you.
What are you talking about? I am the real me. What you see is what you get.
No,
Igwai said.
The real you is the one who showed up to help them because he could. Because it was the right thing. I want to be like that, Kotukan.
Kotuk mulled over the words as they passed over the last of the sloping hills and down to the hut, where their silkworms greedily ate and the forest threatened to consume his piece of paradise. Finally, he stopped the boy by the shoulders and looked him up and down, the way one might a full-grown man.
How about this, Igwai? I will think it over and decide by the week's end. No, do not jump up and down. You are nearly a man, and it's time you acted like one,
Kotuk said. It would quell the boy for a time at least. But the truth was, he would never teach Igwai. The boy held no natural aptitude for it, and the process of awakening his ascendancy would be too dangerous. Kotuk cared too deeply for the boy. It was that love which anchored the last tethers and kept him from truly becoming a ghost. He had long learned Igwai's name, and now he cared far more than he would have liked. Turning, he finally headed into the house, shutting himself in his room with bundles of hard-forgotten memories and regrets. The next day came and went uneventfully, except for a small package of stone-baked flatbread delivered with a note scrawled over in neat, short characters. Opening the letter, Kotuk frowned in confusion. The world was obviously going mad.
Kiko made it through the night,
Thank you. Kotuk, ghost no more.